Thank you very much, Minister. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to be here tonight. Before I make my remarks, I'd really like to also thank Uncle Alan for his welcome to country. It's great to be able to for us all to meet here in the Eora Nation. I'd like to also acknowledge Dr. Fan, the Deputy Governor of the People's Bank of China, His Excellency Mr. Cheng, Ambassador for the People's Republic of China, His Excellency Dr. Gobi, Ambassador for the Argentine Republic, and David Olson, Chair of the Sydney RMB Committee. I also want to congratulate the Department of Premier and Cabinet in New South Wales and the Department for Industry for putting this dialogue together with the Sydney RMB Committee. I also want to welcome all of you who've travelled to Sydney, especially those of you who are from the various offshore RMB centres. We're all here to discuss the internationalisation of the Chinese currency. Now, it's a really important topic, and I say that for two reasons. The first is the internationalisation of the RMB and the associated liberalisation of the Chinese capital account have very significant implications for the global financial system. Indeed, the internationalisation of the RMB could be one of the biggest forces shaping the global financial system over the next decade or so. And the second reason why it's so important is that as the RMB becomes a truly global currency, it's likely to change the way the Chinese economy operates. I think Australia's example provides an example here. In our own case, the internationalisation of the Australian dollar played a really important role in shaping how our economy developed over the past three decades or so. In our case, the internationalisation of the currency was a byproduct of a move to a flexible exchange rate and the abolition of capital controls. And for us, it's been a positive experience, and my expectation is that one day China too would be able to make the same claim. It's easy to understand why the Chinese authorities have sought to have an international currency. As one of the world's largest economies and one that continues to grow in relative importance, it's understandable that China wishes to see the RMB take its place as one of the world's truly global currencies. There are clear advantages of being in this position. Mainland China's financial markets will be deeper and more liquid, lowering the cost of borrowing to business in China. There are obvious advantages in being able to use your own currency in international trade and have global prices quoted in your currency. And being a major reserve currency can also help lower the cost of external finance. So China's ambition is easily understandable. It's clearly making progress towards achieving that ambition. And given that, tonight I would first like to talk about that progress and then to talk about some of the challenges and the opportunities that lie ahead. When we speak of an internationalised currency, what we typically have in mind is a currency that can be used or that is used frequently in international trade and financial transactions between residents and non-residents, and also in transactions that involve just non-residents. This can't be achieved overnight. It takes time. It takes time for non-residents to be comfortable using another currency. They need to have the hedging instruments available to manage the risk effectively, and they need to have a degree of familiarity with the foreign currency. It also takes time for the home authorities to be comfortable allowing their currency to be freely bought and sold by non-residents. So internationalisation isn't something that occurs quickly. Looking at the progress that's been made in China, it's clear that it's been greater for the use of the currency in transactions between residents and non-residents than it has for the use of the currency in transactions between non-residents only. It's particularly so on the trade side, as the Chinese authorities have been encouraging the use of RMB for trade invoicing and settlement for quite some time now. The use of the RMB for trade transactions has clearly been facilitated by the establishment of the offshore RMB centres, and they provide a strong link between the offshore markets and the mainland market. And as you're all aware, these centres are a unique feature of R&B internationalisation, and they're the obvious impetus to this dialogue today and tomorrow. Importantly, market participants should have confidence to use the R&B freely in these centres, as many of the centres have of R&B swap facilities with the People's Bank of China. As such, they play an important role in facilitating R&B transactions between non-residents. And that said, there has recently been a decline in some measures of offshore R&B activity, and I'll touch on that in a moment. Consistent with the experience of other currencies, the increased use of RMB in trade transactions has led to an increase in RMB-denominated financial transactions between residents and non-residents. Most foreign financial institutions now have access to the Chinese bond market, including since last year in a way that was previously only available to central banks and to sovereign wealth funds. Despite this, domestic bonds purchased by foreign investors still only account for around 1 to 1.5% of the market, although the market itself is expanding rapidly. In a sign of further progress, the authorities also intend to create a link between the bond markets in mainland China and Hong Kong later this year. In addition, as of earlier this year, foreign investors are permitted to participate in the domestic foreign exchange derivatives market in China to hedge the currency risk that they take on as part of their bond investments. Foreign investors also have access to China's equity markets through programs such as the Shanghai and Shenzhen Stock Connect schemes with Hong Kong. The Stock Connect schemes have facilitated capital outflows from China, along with other schemes allowing institutional investors to invest offshore. Reflecting the progress in all these dimensions, last year the RMB entered the basket of currencies that determine the value of the IMF special drawing rights. And this followed the IMF's decision in late 2015 to designate the RMB as freely usable. Not surprisingly, an increasing number of countries, including in Australia, invest a portion of their foreign reserves in RMB. In our case, we invest 5% of our reserves in RMB. I would note, though, that according to the IMF's latest figures, the total value of foreign reserves invested in Australian dollars is still significantly higher than that invested in RMB. I expect, though, that will change over time. Our local RMB market in Australia has also been developing, but from a low base. The Reserve Bank of Australia collect regular data on the size of the market, and those data show that the value of RMB deposits held with Australian resident banks rose strongly in 2015, and it's been broadly steady over the past year at around 30 to 40 billion RMB. Consistent with this, the annual data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics show that the share of Australia's trade with China invoiced in RMB has also continued to rise over recent years. In contrast to the experience here in Australia, the share of China's total trade invoiced or settled in RMB has in fact declined over recent times. After peaking at around 30% in 2015, that share is currently 15 to 20%. This decline in the share of RMB payments for imports has contributed to a decline in the stock of RMB deposits in the offshore centres, given that the supply of RMB to these centres is largely through the RMB trade payments. I think, as Dr. Ma touched on earlier today, part of the rise and the subsequent fall in the offshore RMB deposits reflects changed expectations about the future path of the RMB. But there's also been underlying growth in demand for offshore RMB deposits for transaction purposes, with investors actively seeking to manage their exposure to exchange rate fluctuations. So putting all this together, there's been significant progress on many fronts. Indeed, there's been more progress than many observers had expected. Despite all this, there is still some way to go for the RMB to be a truly internationalised currency. An obvious question then is how to build on the significant progress that's been made so far. One lesson from experience elsewhere, including our own, is that having an internationalised currency requires an open capital account. It requires allowing domestic citizens to buy and sell assets overseas and allowing non-residents to buy and sell assets domestically. The flows generated from these transactions generate depth in financial markets, and that depth provides a stimulus to the development of other markets. This then encourages more transactions and a form of virtuous circle develops, and this is certainly what happened in Australia. Interesting, though, in our own case, at no point did we have the strategic objective of having an internationalised currency. Rather, it happened rather organically as the result of market forces in an open system. China too has been gradually moving in this direction, but the process of opening up is having its challenges. And there are two of these that I would like to point out. The first is managing the volatility in capital flows that can be associated with a more open capital account. And the second is managing the implications for global markets and global investment patterns. The first of these challenges, dealing with volatility, is one that faces any country moving from a highly constrained system to a more liberal system. As the constraints are lifted, people adjust their portfolios in ways that they previously were not able to do. These adjustments can then lead to sharp and disruptive movements in key prices in the economy, particularly exchange rates, especially when markets are not fully mature. To date, though, the Chinese authorities have largely avoided the volatility in market prices, although changes in expectations about the path of the exchange rate have affected capital flows into and out of China. For a number of years, up until mid-2014, the RMB had been considered a one-way bet to appreciate against the US dollar. Foreign capital flowed into China, not just to take advantage of the higher returns available there, but also to take advantage of the appreciation of the currency. As capital flowed into China, the central bank offset some of the upward pressure on the exchange rate by purchasing foreign exchange and buying foreign assets. Over the past couple of years, though, things have changed, with the RMB depreciating against the US dollar, and there have been persistent expectations of further depreciation. Chinese residents have taken advantage of some of the new freedoms to increase foreign investment, and the depreciating exchange rate has increased their incentive to do this. Mainland companies also appear to have delayed their export receipts and prepaid for imports in anticipation of the RMB being weaker in the future. And they've also boosted their foreign currency deposits by holding onto foreign currency trade receipts rather than converting them to RMB and using them to pay foreign currency loans. In response to these changes, the Chinese authorities have sold some of their foreign assets that they previously purchased. And as a result, China's foreign exchange reserves have declined from a peak of around $4 trillion US dollars in mid-14 to around $3 trillion now. Fewer foreign assets are now held by the central bank, and more are being held by other Chinese entities. And as the People's Bank of China has stated, this is a desirable shift. The Chinese authorities are understandably concerned that, left unchecked, the turnaround in capital flows could be destabilising. As a result, there's been some tightening up in the ability of Chinese residents to purchase foreign assets. The available data, as well as various reports from China, suggest that these measures have slowed the outflow of capital. It shouldn't come as a surprise that the Chinese authorities are proceeding cautiously in this area, and they've sought temporarily to slow outflows or inflows from time to time. While many countries have liberalised their capital account and made their exchange rates more flexible, few, if any, have been able to do this without at least some disruption to their domestic financial system. Short-term capital controls can have a positive effect on financial stability by reducing the risk of disorderly currency adjustments and pressures in financial markets. But there is a balance to be struck here, as tightening up capital controls does run counter to the longer-run goal. One consideration is the signal that tightening of controls after several years of liberalisation could send to investors about how the government perceives the balance of risk facing the economy. A broad-based and persistent tightening of capital controls might also exacerbate domestic vulnerabilities by causing domestic liquidity to be greater than might be otherwise desired from a strict macro perspective. Ultimately, there's a balancing act to be carried out here, balancing these various risks. The Chinese authorities have managed this quite well so far. The second challenge for China is dealing with the implications for the global system. Unlike the challenge of dealing with volatility, this challenge is not one that most other countries have faced. It's an issue for China because of its size. When Australia opened its capital account, the rest of the world hardly paid any attention. This is not the case for China. The rest of the world is watching carefully, and it has a very strong interest in the outcome. China's gross portfolio flows remain small relative to the size of the economy. As my predecessor Glenn Stevens noted in a speech a couple of years ago, if China's gross portfolio flows were equivalent to 5% of GDP, that's the figure for many countries in Asia and just a bit less than that in Australia, China would account for a little more than one-fifth of global portfolio flows. At the moment, its share is much, much smaller than that. Because of China's size, investment by Chinese entities abroad has the potential to affect the prices of many assets, in some cases significantly. We've already seen some signs of this with, for example, housing prices in some cities around the world being affected by the inflow of Chinese money. The nature of the foreign assets owned by Chinese entities is also changing, as the central bank has had a different portfolio composition to that of most other Chinese entities. In many countries, a related issue is the purchase of domestic assets by Chinese state-owned enterprises. There have been a few high-profile cases where governments have blocked deals by Chinese state-owned enterprises. But by and large, most countries, including here in Australia, have welcomed Chinese investors in a wide range of assets. Chinese capital here and elsewhere is helping build businesses, and it's helping build stronger trade links. So there are a lot of issues here to be managed both for China and the rest of the world. To conclude, China is going through an important transition. It wasn't that long ago that the Chinese currency could only be used within Chinese borders. In contrast, today China has the ambition of having a truly global currency. The effects of this transition, involving the internationalisation of the RMB and the opening up of the capital account, could ultimately be as wide-ranging as were the effects of China's accession into the World Trade Organization, as the minister said before. Well managed, this transition can be a win-win for both China and for the rest of the world and for us here in Australia as well. So thank you. I would normally, when I speak, take questions. But we're in a blackout period before our monetary policy meeting next Tuesday, so I'm going to spare you that and allow you to proceed with dinner. Thank you very much.